I kind of lean back.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, being broadcast live here on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is author, researcher, and historian Art Campbell. But before we get started, a couple of announcements we need to get out there. I want to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. And also remind everyone on the Truckers UFO Reporting Center, these hardworking individuals are out there 24/7. So if you guys spot anything, be sure to report it to www.tuforc.com. Twofork.com. And also, I want to let everyone know that over the last few days, our GoDaddy podcast site has been down, so it is back in order. There was some issue on GoDaddy's end, which has been resolved. The page has been updated by our producer, Joe Montaldo, and I think everyone will be really impressed with the new look of the site. And concerning Art Campbell, he served his country during the Korean War at Naval Shore Installations and at a fleet electronics training unit aboard the aircraft carrier, the USS Boxer. After leaving the Navy in the mid-50s, he became active in UFO investigation and research and started a NICAP affiliate in Kansas City, Missouri. Working with NICAP's Donald E. Kehoe in 1958 and 59, he was involved in a letter sent to ex-President Truman from Kehoe in 1959. Art will be joining me tonight and again next week to discuss two amazing topics. Tonight we will address the possible UFO crash at St. Augustine. And I think our discussion tonight and Art's research will bring some answers to the question of, did a UFO crash on the plains of St. Augustine in 1947? Boy, Art, you've had dealings in this subject for a long time.
It has been a long time. I started in the late 50s. Now, I took 30 years out to be a teacher, but I picked it up again when I retired in 1989.
What got you started in research? Started your interest in the subject?
Well, I read Scully's book in 1952. I was stationed in San Diego with an air station there. And I picked it up at one of those newsstands, and they had a boat that went between North Island and downtown San Diego, the foot of Broadway there. They called it the Nickel Snatcher. It costs more now. I think, well, actually, there's a bridge now, so, but those days they had a little ferry. And I was reading it, picked up the book there at the little newsstand, and that got me kind of interested in it, and then I wasn't much around for the next couple of years, and my first big book was Adamski's book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, and that really got me interested. I later investigated him for a Kehoe, but initially it was his Adamski's book and Scully's book.
Huh, that's interesting. I didn't know that you had investigated Adamski.
When we were doing setting up our NICAP affiliate, and I'd been affiliated with another group called the Kansas City UFO Study Club, and had kind of drifted away from them, and they invited George Adamski to speak to them in, I believe, December of 1959, and he came in and did his talk, and then spent some time with the club president, and then had to go to Davenport, Iowa, to another talk, and he left his companion, Lucy McGinnis, in Kansas City. But when they came back, Dansky, those days it was all railroad, of course, met him at the train station, and he said, hand Lucy McGinnis a ticket. So you better get her money back. We don't need this. They took me up there to Flying Saucer. So he claimed that he had been taken out of the Kansas City train yard by a UFO and to Davenport, Iowa. Now, I don't know whether they followed the highways of the day or what, but they anyhow landed at Davenport somewhere. He gave his talk, and he didn't say how he returned. So I found out about this, and sent a telegram to Kehoe, and I said, Dan, if you claim contact Kansas City train yard, stop. That's all I could afford about in those days. I was a support student. You want to investigate, stop. And he wrote back and says, go. So we're off and running and investigating George Dembski in the Kansas City train yard, and it turned out to be a totally bogus claim. The train didn't stop. He couldn't have gotten off if it had. Our whole book, the UFO Crash of San Augustine, the second chapter is called George Dembski and the Rock Island 508, and it's well explained in there.
And just before we started, you had said that if our listeners wanted to, that there was on your website, if you'd like to give your website also, that where they could see the titles and whatnot of your book.
Yes,
the
that's correct.
Of the
I
book.
Have my website. If I could give them the name of it here, it's the UFO Crash Book. UFOCrashBook.com. And there's two segments to it. One of them deals with Eisenhower. It's not up right now, but the main one, the first one that comes up on Google, is the one they would want, dealing with the UFO crash on the plane to San Augustine. So when the screen starts turning black, they'll probably be there. It's UFOCrashBook.com, and there's about four or five pages dealing with some of the work I've been doing and Google right there. And
we'd like to let everyone know that your website is being updated, and so there's several pages that won't come up because
that's
it's all
about Eisenhower. We'll be talking about next week, but everything on this particular topic today is on the website. Yes.
So if you want to follow along,
sure. Okay,
website,
I'm looking over the chapter headings. Down where it says scroll down, UFO crash San Augustine, 15 chapters and 100 color photographs, and I'm just going to click on them. The chapters we deal in the first chapter with the letter from Donald Kehoe to President Truman. Truman was a short-tailed relative of my father's, and my father didn't know I talked to him about UFOs, but I did about 1958 or 9, very briefly. But that's explained in the book when I met him in an impromptu meeting at his library one day and asked him if he knew Donald Kehoe. And the picture of him there is on the chapter one, The Buck Stopped Here, on the website. And click on that red chapter one, you'll see the Kehoe and Truman. And, I found a letter that Kehoe had written 36 years later. And in there is Senator Barry Goldwater and the Senator Lyndon Johnson and all kinds of people that Kehoe was trying to impress Truman with. Later they turned out to be presidential candidates. One was the president. I didn't know he'd written it, and I kind of lost track of him when I went to teaching in 59, went out west to Colorado, and I was also a coach. So the first chapter is that letter from Donald Kehoe to Truman asking him if he would please sponsor some hearings. And he quotes Dr. Carl Jung and others, other individuals, and we have in the appendix five or six pages of documentation that Kehoe sent to Truman in 1959. That starts our appendix. Second chapter, and just stop me when you have any questions or anything, deals with the George Dembski and the Rock Island 508. And we have a picture of Dembski there that was taken in those days. And the Kansas City train yard, and the Rock Island train is there. And it was quite a preposterous claim. I think what was happening was he was heading to England. And some of the early contactees had to kind of invent new things, so when they went somewhere else, it had something new to talk about. You would be assured of having be invited somewhere if you had some new, spectacular experience. So I think London was quite a ways from Kansas City, and he thought he could pull it off. But we kind of nipped him in the bud before he even got to London, and I think he was supposed to meet with the Queen. That was dashed real quick. He did get to see Queen Juliana of the Netherlands on that one trip. But anyhow, that letter is that from Keyhole of Truman in the first chapter, and then our report on George Adamski in the Rock Island 508, that was the number of the train, is in our chapter two.
You know, when I think of the early contactee movement, I think of people like George Adamski and a lady who later became known as Spaceship Ruthie.
I didn't run on to Ruthie. Remember her given name?
Ruth. Oh gosh, I can't think of her real last name. She used to be on the old TV show Real People a lot back in the '70s.
What was Long John Silver stuff? Was that Los Angeles disc jockey that had Long John? Was it Silver?
Long John Noble.
Noble, yeah, sure, yeah, that was it, yeah. Well, they had the early conventions were in the early mid-50s, and apparently they had the first one at the Hollywood Roosevelt, I believe, hotel. And I think later that's where wasn't JFK assassinated there? In any case, they had some conventions, and I think Adamski and a whole lot of them attended the first one, and then Adamski kind of brought, he was kind of an independent loner, and he kind of branched off and went on his own. And then they started, George Van Tassel started having him out at Giant Rock in the desert out near Palm Springs area somewhere. We went out there once, I think it's 58 or so. And it was quite a collection of people. I'll say that for it. But
I had kind of jumped ahead myself. I went to the chapter three.
Well, I'm there also, so.
And I was just curious, the antenna dishes that are showing in the little black and white shot on the right, is that the very large array out there?
Yes, it is, yeah. We worked for 13 years at our site, about 10 miles south of there. I'd go by there every day on the way from, if I was at Socorro, I usually stayed over in Dattle, which is about 10 miles west of there. But every time you go to Socorro, there was a very large array. And that's also on the cover of the book. And, while we're on that, if they would like to scroll back to the, home page, let's go back up there for a second, and I'll describe to those who don't have a computer what we're looking at. We're going back to the home page, and there's a lady pointing at a large UFO over some of those dishes at the VLA. And this was a lady who was a government employee, a grandmother, two or three times over, who worked at the Soil Conservation Service office there in Dattle. And her name was Loretta Hargis. And she told me that in 1982, we've gone back to the home page of the website, and she told me in 1982 that the UFO had followed her out from Socorro after she'd taken her kids to the doctor, and it followed her down the highway. Now, she didn't say it was following her, but it was running parallel to the highway, and it was going very slow at the same pace that other traffic was going on the highway. And she pulled out to take a look at it, and some other people pulled off at the same time, and this UFO literally hovered over the very large array. 1982, and then took off down southwest towards the Horse Mountain. But that's what we have on our homepage. And those of you who are driving or out somewhere, when you get home, you might want to take a look at that UFOCrashBook.com. That's what we're seeing there is a reenactment of that craft that she saw. She said it was about 100 feet in diameter. And I said, Loretta, how would you judge 100 feet? She says, I'm a rancher. I've got to know what's my distances are to be safe with my kids and my family. She says, 100 feet is about 10 fence posts. And we drive, we put them in about 10 feet apart. And we also put them wider when we have putting in a gate so a trailer could swing through it. And she said it covered the highway, and the highway was 22 feet, and it stuck out on both sides considerably. So this gal knew her distance. And she also worked for the Soil Conservation Service and had assisted some surveyors in the field, so she knew her distances. So she's pointing at a 100-foot UFO hovering over VLA. And she said, you know, all that electronic stuff there, all those numbers going, those signals going out in outer space. And she said, they've got a building over there that just, there's no windows in it. She said, you know, if they put some windows in that building there, they might see some. And I thought that was a very, very, this is a local lady. Well, this right near the, and so, well, I'm going to go back to take another, chapter three is the plane of Saint Augustine, and we talked about that. That's the VLA there. And it's 52 miles long, and it varies in width from 20 to 10 miles. It's an old ice age melt lake, meaning that it, when the glaciers in the hills melted 12,000 years ago at the Pleistocene Ice Age period, the end of that period, this basin filled up with about 135 feet of water at its deepest. We're looking at the north end of it, but at the southeast end of it, it was deeper. And the last of the water left about 5,000 years ago. And the Native Americans followed the water down to the edge as it receded. They would build new camps, and then they'd have it. The water, with, you know, 10 years later would be recede even more. So they kept building campsites, and this brought the archaeologists there, and it was a very rich area for archaeologists because of the numerous campsites. And when the lake was there, there was a lot of bird life. Wildlife would come in there and so forth. So it was really quite an interesting, a lucrative place to be. But we're working, actually our site isn't on this near here, but we're about 5 miles south of the hills that we see there in that chapter. Now the big thing that we found, and this was featured, by the way, on the History Channel in December. It's called our chapter was That Ain't No Part No Cow. The story behind that, this thing is about 5 or 6 inches long, 4 inches wide, weighs about 5 ounces. Pardon me. And when we found it, I believe in July, the anniversary of the Roswell crash, about 1995. And they were all over there whooping it up at Roswell, and I was out on a plane to Saint Augustine in the sandstorm. And when it subsided, this was under a piece of sagebrush. The wind had blown off the most of the thing. We're looking here, for those who can't see it, something that looks like, my first impression was, it looks like chicken fat that you take off a piece of chicken and lay in the sink. But what's it doing in the middle of the desert? And it turned out to be a hollow bag affair that had been collapsed, and we think that we know it's made out of high-density polyethylene, and it was amorphous, which means it did not have a crystalline structure, and it's possibly some kind of a body organ from an alien. That's our best guess, and we get a lot of interest in the, and we have a whole chapter devoted to this, we talk about what we found inside. The next, our chapter five deals with the digging at the site. And by 2004 or five, I had quite a bit of interest. And Chuck Wade and his wife Nancy brought down four or five Navajos, and we had four teams digging with frames and sifting the area that went through the sagebrush there. And I'd gotten the information from a map from a rancher, and he didn't have time to show it to me, but he said, I'll show you where it is. And he'd bought the property from the guy he bought the property from, that something came through that sagebrush, and no sagebrush would grow there now. So there's a gap about 135 feet long, about 25 or 30 feet wide, and that's pretty much where we spent most of our time. In the sixth chapter of the book,
what kind of items did you find during that dig?
We had about six digs. That was the 2004 dig, and mostly we found foil, and it didn't have any memory. By the way, you could water it up; it would stay watered up. You could make spitballs out of this stuff and throw them at school. It was it wouldn't unfold at all, but. We have some of that later coming up, but on the next chapter, six, we show what we found inside of the artifact. We call this thing the artifact. And we found a piece of starch. It was cellulose starch, and it spent almost $2,000 having it analyzed. And on the starch, under a microscope, was a piece of gold wire. And I was in a college biology lab. And the beautiful redhead girl sat next to me. And we were kind of talking and looking at each other. And I said, what do you think this is? She said, well, I don't know. It's like gold to me. And, well, it's like gold to me, too. And I said, could I... I had to delicately ask her for one of her red hairs out of her... was it 2 feet of the microscope there? She laid one on there, and then we taped down both ends of it and took this picture. And the hair is 70 microns, and the piece of gold wire is about 10 microns, 7 or 8 microns. And the component in the center is about 8 or 12 microns. So we're looking here at a red, in the chapter 6, a red human hair, and next to a gold wire. And that's probably the most spectacular thing we found. And we went to get it analyzed again a little later. And the gold wire had jumped off. It jumped off with some magnetic thing. We never saw it again. Well, I'm sure, God, we got a picture of it. We found a little, our seventh chapter of the book deals with a little cross that we found. And obviously, it had been stuck at the ground at one time, and there was nothing like it anywhere near it. And we figured it had been there to mark something. So this is where we started our digging in 1996. And we found a lot of material there. Some of it, quite a bit of it, is little pieces of things that were obviously from this earth. But we found some things that we couldn't identify, including some pieces of wax, found some more foil. And apparently there had been some people there over the years at that spot, because we found a fire ring. And in the fire ring, we found broken bottles, sardine can type things, so forth, so on. So, and it's also right on top of the prairie dog complex. And we wanted to make sure that the prairie dogs weren't active, nor the pack rats. We did a little smoke and fire magic in the hole to make sure there was nothing in there. Because you know those western pack rats and all the rodents, there's a good chance, a 30% chance, that you get the hantavirus, which is very similar to the Black Plague, and nobody wants to deal with that. So we made sure there was nothing in there before we started digging. Anyhow, the first thing we did was under the cross, and it had been erected by someone for some time in the past. And we spent some time analyzing it, hypothesizing what it might have been. We think somebody came back to visit on several occasions, possibly, and we found broken wide-mouth bottles near there, and that's significant because there's a lot of wildflowers nearby. So somebody had come back and had this cross there for whatever reason. Of course, this is a site where the civil engineer said that there was four alien bodies, and that may have something to do with it. The next one is Chapter 8, deals with some of the foil you asked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that first thing we have is called a wafer. It's about the size of a fig newt. And it It was charcoal inside, and both outside is ceramic. And we think it might have been a filter of some kind, so a little thing above it because we found the ground. And for those of you who are just tuning in, we are at a website called UFOCrashBook.com, and we're perusing some of the chapters in the book with some full-screen color photographs. And we're at the eighth chapter of the book, and the metal analysis of the wafer, and that metal is what we found. Some of it was folded like wadded up, and some of it was like we found four pieces folded together, kind of like you buy taco shells in the store. And it was buried under the sand, and once in a while when it would rain and we'd get a wind, we'd find a piece of it protruding. So we went really to a pristine site. Much of the stuff we found was on the surface. The wafer was found by a ranch lady whose dad owned the property. And one day I went up for a cup of coffee to talk to her, and she said, when you finish that sleep roll, I got something here I want you to look at. And I thought it was something to eat. She just made it. She popped this thing on my plate. And like I say, it was about the size of a little fake newt, and it certainly wasn't going to eat it. But it had heavy, it weighed about 3 or 4 ounces, and it had charcoal inside between two layers of ceramic. It kind of reminded me of one of those diatomaceous earth things that we used to have around swimming pool filters. And inside being charcoal, I think that probably has a bearing on it. And but these pieces of the pencil there are shown for comparison, and some of them were 4 or 5 inches square, some were 2 inches, some were just little tiny scraps. The smallest one turned out to have a coated with silicon on both sides, with foil in the middle. And we've had considerable analysis on that one, and that's part of what we're seeing. And then if you want to ask any questions or whatever, feel free.
What was the analysis on this aluminum then?
Well, it varied. It wasn't all the same. As a matter of fact, we had a Navajo crew working site 204 found heavy piece of, well, that was a heavier piece. We found, it was very heavy silicon, and there's generally not more than 2 or 3 ounces of silicon in a standard aluminum foil, and we had as much as 13 to 14%. And there's nothing on the market that we had came anywhere close. Your standard household foil, Reynolds wrap, the Alcoa, whatever you have, is has 0.5% silicon in it. Now the table or periodic element chart for silicon is the SI, and your foil also in the kitchen cupboard has 0.5% of iron in it. That makes it just a little bit better foil, but it's 95% and 5100% aluminum. And this material we found there didn't match any known foil. There's about 60 different kinds of foil made around the world, and 600 kinds of aluminum formulations, and we could find none of the material that was patented from the aluminum industry that matched anything we found. It's not terribly spectacular, and but I don't know why anybody would use foil, thin foil, in any kind of a UFO craft. But we did some analysis on it and found out that the New Mexico Bureau of Geology cross section of that little piece of foil with the pencil eraser in the chapter we're working on. Said that it had uh, silicon coating on each side of the foil with silicon in the center. And we were able to get a microscopic cross-section photograph of it. And we would probably found, myself and the other diggers by that time, probably found a couple of square feet of foil in small pieces here and there. And one of the questions we get was, well, why couldn't the Army pick it up? Well, if you know the arroyo material, what the arroyo looks like, and this is in a very wide arroyo, about 300 yards wide, and it comes out of a mountain, and goes all the way out onto the plains. That's how the water works its way down into the plains area. None of it, by the way, stands. It all soaks in. And so the arroyo is what's called sandy loam. It's about 50% dirt and about 50% sand. And you could kick it with your toe and make a considerable dent. And there's sagebrush in it also. And so if something had come in and crashed there, it would have been a huge cloud of dust. And when the dust settled, it would be settling on top of all of the material that that wasn't protruding. The civil engineer did recall the Army coming in there. And he chased them off. He and a group of archaeologists were, the civil engineer and some archaeologists were chased off the site. And a lot of this stuff would have not been visible if it had been under several inches of sandy loam. And, of course, there's not many yard rigs in that part of the country. So I don't think the military was out there digging around trying to see what they could find. But we think it probably worked its way up to the surface over the years as the sand and water in the arroyo became lower, and I'd find some after a rain I wouldn't see before. There's quite a bit of it there. First square foot, maybe 18 inches, maybe 2 feet. I have most of it. But, it's a fascinating stuff, but we have the slightest idea of what the white foil would be doing in a UFO.
That's interesting, because you do bring up a good point about things, you know, being buried and hidden, you know, just by geological action or wind and weather.
Well, that's what brought the archaeologists to the plains, was this wind and weather working on the sandy soil. And it would uncover graves, skeletons, artifacts. I have some beautiful spear points coming up one of the next chapters. And this guy found these things on the surface. Now, this was 1,500 to 3,000 years before the bow and arrow was invented. We're talking large animal spear points here. And they found those laying on the surface at various spots in the plains. Well, somebody asked me in a lecture one time, well, why don't the cowboys see them riding around? I said, well, the cowboys, as you may have noticed, are now in pickup trucks. And they stay on roads. And if they want to feed cattle, they throw the hay out the back and the cattle come get it. So you don't find a whole lot of cowboys out there on the range riding in some of these areas. And they told me that if I was going to drive anywhere where there was grass, to be sure and drive in the same tracks I did coming out so I wouldn't ruin too much grass. So there were very few people around here at all. It didn't need to be. If you just could drive in with your truck, you don't throw out your stuff, or round up your cattle and get them into the low boy or whatever. Over on the ninth chapter deals with the civil engineer, Grady Barnett, and his wife, and he was a World War I officer. He went in, and in 18 months in World War I, he went in 1917, December 17, he went from recruit to captain, and which is just shows you what kind of a man he was, very high integrity. And our eighth, ninth chapter shows him with his wife in front of a 1917 Dodge. And the other picture we have there of him shows him at Socorro at his house in 1948, a year after the event happened.
If I remember correctly, the story of Bernie Barnett was brought to light, I guess you could say, by some people who knew him.
Yes, as a matter of fact, he passed away in 69. But his niece, he had told her the story, and her husband. They had come to visit in Thanksgiving of 1947. And as a matter of fact, his wife kept a diary and talking about them being there. And he flew in, this fellow from Dalhart, and they had known Ruth as this gal used to sit for her, I guess, babysit for her, very young. And that's his wife. And then the men went out and flew around, and I bet you a cookie they flew up there to the site. But I can't, there's no way I could ever prove it. But he was chased off of the army, but I think he would be, three or four months later, would have courage enough to fly over it. And she said we first learned about it in the fall of 1947 when we went to visit them for Thanksgiving. But they never wrote about it. Never wrote about it at all. I think they had really been intimidated by the military people at the site that ran them off.
Well, a lot of people who were confronted during, you know, the Roswell incident, as most people know it by, has come forward saying that the Army was very threatening.
Well, I think they would have been, and you know, they weren't. The Army wasn't into public relations, after having won the World War II on two fronts, the Pacific and Eastern, and with of course with our allies, and they didn't quite get into the finesse of dealing politely with the public and so forth. These guys had orders to get the people out of there, you know. So I don't think there were too many of these sergeants or what have you at the major in psychology. So they're going to just get them out the way they can. But it's interesting to note that in the many of your people have probably read the Roswell incident, the Burritz and Moore 1980 book. But they described the plane to San Augustine potential crash site in there, and go into some detail about Barnett. And also, Stanton Friedman's a very nice book, Crash Corona, talks about the Barnett connection. Barnett had described, as the first civilian witness we know of to describe the gray aliens. Now, it didn't show up till the Burritz and Moore book in 1980, but he described them to his relatives and people in 1947 when he saw them. And he said he couldn't tell anybody about it, even if he wanted to. He didn't want to lose his job. He'd gotten his job in the Depression in 1935, and this was 11 years later, and he wanted to make it to retirement, and so he didn't want to talk about it either. So there was no problem about him blabbing it around town, because he would lose his credibility. He was a surveyor and quite a well-known man in the area. And one guy did talk to him, a fellow named William Leed. We have the picture in Chapter 10. And William Leed was a military officer who was over at Fort Bliss in Texas, that near San Antonio. And had come over to see Barnett. And he was one of the few corroborating witnesses we had. He'd gotten his information while he was stationed at the Pentagon, helping to declassify some papers, by the way, which were UFO papers, some other kind of papers. And a colonel there at a coffee shop says, "Well, are you interested in UFOs?" He says, "Oh, yeah." He says, "Well," he says, "if you want to talk to somebody who's seen one and touched one, you want to talk to a civil engineer named Grady Barnett at Socorro, New Mexico." So in 1967, Lee told me that he had driven through Roswell on his way to Socorro and had just decided to drop in on Barnett. And he had he was in declining health, but he did let him in. He did say, "Yes, I did see one," and told him about it. And Lee said, "I just kicked myself," because he's still alive now. He's back in New York somewhere. "I didn't ask him about bodies." And apparently, Barnett wasn't about to volunteer it. He'd been visited by military people who told him, make sure you stay quiet now. This was a guy in declining health, so they must have been really worried about the communists or somebody finding out about that crash. Because they worked really hard to keep that thing quiet. But anyhow, this information came through the Pentagon to an officer who decided on his own to go visit Barnett in 1967.
Now that's an aspect of Barnett's story that I was unaware of.
Yeah, he has quite an interesting story, and I have his wife had a diary, and we know that he was on the plane to San Augustine, 15 miles south of the VLA. By the way, the VLA was a very large array. Those radio telescopes wasn't built until finished till 1982. It just started in 78 or 9, and. Each one of those dishes cost $76 million. So this was an early NASA SETI operation, sending messages out to others, listening to what's going on out in the universe. So
actually, I've been to the visitor center there. It's an interesting facility.
Oh, it is an interesting facility, and I've been asked to speak there at one time, but I was in the area and I couldn't afford to go down there. They weren't paying my way, but they asked if I was the guy that did the book on his UFO crash on the plane. I said, yes, I am. I said, well, when you ever get down this plane, we'd like to have you talk to our staff. But I'm not going to recommend they put windows in there, I'll tell you that. But I'm moving on now through that, scrolling on down through those chapters. And then we talk about Barnett and his work, and then the next one deals with the archaeologist. Now here's a story, it goes all the way to Harvard. On the chapter 11, I clicked on the next chapter, I'm on chapter 11. The skeleton is not one that I found, but it was in a book, shows you what they were finding, very shallow graves. And this is a complete one. But the gentleman on the right is holding some of the points that they found there. Now, those are spear points. That was several, 1,500 to several thousand years before they invented the bow and arrow. So that meant that man had to, whatever the game he was getting, he had to run up and stab it, or at least throw the spear at it. So those points on the left, the little ones with the flutes on the end are called Clovis points. And I believe there's a Sandia 1 there, which puts it about 11,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago. And he found those points up on the plain of San Augustine, and he said that two of them were laying on top of the ground. A spectacular find for somebody. And that's what happened. They were under the ground for years, and the rain and the wind cleared them off, and whatever goes on the ground usually stays there, and the dirt moves up out to the center or the edge of the plains, and it kind of percolates out there with water. It goes down. It's kind of spongy, but some of those remains stay on the surface. And so the archaeologist that everyone knew was working with that area in 1947, was named Herbert Dick, and he was a Harvard archaeologist, and we're talking about it. Chapter 12 here, and he went out to the plain of San Augustine in 1947, was doing a preliminary dig for a big dig to in 1948, and there was some competition for who was going to get the dig out here first. It was really some pristine ground, and he got into a competition with a man named Hurt, and beat him out there, beat him out several months out there. And got out there, did his work, but ironically, we're sure that he's there, camped the first night 10 miles away when the UFO came down. And,
wow.
This is the famous, this is the archaeology connection. Now, he wouldn't admit it, and none of the people would admit it who were with him. His wife's still alive, I think, down in Tahoe somewhere. I haven't talked to her, but and I'm not sure that I will, but they said... that they weren't there, that they were there later, I was reading, I scrolled on down here onto the Harvard Dick letters down below his photo there on the website, And our, and he said, we didn't go to the plane to San Augustine in July 47. And on page 3 of the letter he wrote to his advisor, he says, our party proceeded to the plane to San Augustine on July 1st, 1947. The Roswell crash was supposed to have happened the night of the 2nd. The night of the 1st or 2nd. And so we spent 2 weeks carefully contouring, mapping, and so forth and so on. But some of the statements they made to other people down there, down below that letter, we weren't there in early July. The evidence indicates that Dick and his group were not on the plane to San Augustine. And then he said, if I knew anything, I would tell you. People did find him in the 90s, early 90s. He died about 92. I think they were talking to him as early as 88. But there were a party of six of them. By the way, three of them were related. His wife and brother-in-law and father were a part of the party. So it'd be fairly easy to keep the whole thing quiet. Now, of course, if he had said that, well, we'd seen a UFO and be chased off by the Army, he doesn't get his doctorate. He's not going to be telling a tale like that and getting a doctorate from Harvard. So he had every reason to keep quiet, too. And we discovered the letter in his files, and it was written to an advisor of his concerning the friction he was having with the other guy. They flat out did not tell the truth about being there. Now, that doesn't mean that they saw the UFO crash, but they were the only archaeology party working near there. So good chance it was them. Oh, down to chapter 13, we deal with, this is one of the most interesting finds, we have the shoe sole. And we found two. One was one half sole broken in half, and one that's about 4.5 inches long, and it's made of 9 different layers. And several of the layers are cotton with unknown substances added to them. Plain old ordinary cotton. We found nylon thread here and there. We found some cotton and rubber put together and an unknown substance. We found some lecithin oil in one of the layers of rubber, which somebody said, that's interesting because that's supposed to be good for tired feet. So somebody wants a concession and putting lecithin oil in shoe soles might be something they want to look into. And this was we did a little mock-up of what it might have looked like. And but this was on the surface. The second year I was there, I found it. And one other thing that was just laying on the surface, back in the sagebrush. And our chapter, the last chapter, deals with some of the things we found. We found that I'm on to chapter 14 now, UFOCrashBook.com, and we're looking at the UFO Crash San Augustine book, and it shows the shoe sole, and we found a clip of M1 shells and some other shells, which many of your listeners will remember. M1 was a standard military rifle for World War II, and we used it up into the early 50s, at least. And these were 30 caliber cartridges, and apparently there was a military bivouac near there. Now, I don't think they were shooting down there. I don't think they would have known it was there. But there was, down behind some trees was a military bivouac, and these may have fallen out of a pack or something. And somebody laid them out there and forgot them, what have you. And then we have what the shoe sole would look like if you were to open it up. We found remnants of all those things in that order, with rubber on the bottom and the cotton, vulcanized, we call it, foam pad, like polyurethane, 2 different types of fabric, and the bottom fabric had been red, which would indicate that the fabric wrapping up around the upper part of the shoe was red. And gray uniforms and red shoes wouldn't have been too sharp. It wouldn't have been too bad, really, you know, if that's what these were. And we found pieces of fabric sticking out from and so forth. And but that kind of gives you a peruse view through the chapters, and we deal with some of the things we found a smashed canteen in chapter 15, and a wrangler who was hired, that was lived nearby there, was told his family that he was hired by the Army to pick up some material over a period of time. And I think they had gotten the UFO out of there, but they had this guy who lived nearby pick up stuff for them. But he turned it all into them. And so apparently they were down there concerned about, you know, when it would rain, the stuff would show up. So they had him go down, I guess, and keep picking it up. He lives about a half mile away. And we get into some of the Colonel Corso material. We've had some of your listeners may remember Colonel Corso wrote The Day After Roswell. And dealing with some of the alien material, he said he was had material on alien anatomy. And we were comparing some of the material we had with what he had. And as close as we could come to what that thing in the first chapter might be, that certainly wasn't part of the cow, that's for sure. A couple of cattle inspectors in a restaurant said that to me one night, and I said, well, that'd be a good title for a chapter. So Corso said that when he was at the Pentagon and he had alien material in his hands, that they were analyzing it, and he thought that the aliens, being hundreds of years ahead of us, had taken clones. Apparently the little grays that we see, that we hear about in UFOs, are not biological necessarily. They may be biological, but they take clones. They added artificial parts to them to make them more suitable for the rigors of space travel. And that thing that we found may have been one of those parts. So that's the kind of a walk through the book. It's available if anybody wants to. I think it says that. Tells how to order it. And it's a CD also.
What's your opinion of Corso's book, The Day After Roswell?
I spoke to Bill Burns about that. He was the co-author, Bill Burns was. Bill said that they were being pressured by a publisher. But Burns is a publisher, but he didn't publish the book, so he just helped write it. And they didn't have time to get a lot of things checked out. And it was put out very quickly, trying to capitalize on get it done by the 1997, when the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event took place. So they kind of hurried it, Burns said, and he had some regrets. They did get it out. And he said there was a lot of things in there we could have done better. Corso died, of course, later in 97. So if we hadn't gotten it out, it wouldn't have been out at all, which is fortunate for us. But I think that he wanted to talk about the bases on the moon and the rockets and so forth and so on, and had a lot more information that he wanted to get out, but they pretty well had to keep the book down to what he had done at the Pentagon and the materials that he had. And I think he was an honest man. I think he was in his, getting on in years, and you cannot expect a person, I think he's 85 at the time he passed away, to have perfect recall of events. But I think he was the first leg, as you have it, of our eventual disclosure. I think he will be the first one that came out of the government that said we flying saucers are real, and I think we owe that to him.
I have a copy of his book and had read through it, and actually we've got three copies. I had bought one, and my husband had a copy, and then my sister a year or two later gave us another one, not knowing that we had already had two copies.
Yes.
Well, I think it's close enough time for us to go to a break that we could go ahead and go now. This looks like a good spot to do that. So we'll be back here in a few minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. And tonight we've been talking with Art Campbell. During the break, Art, you were telling me, a tidbit about Philip Corso's book.
On our homepage, we have a button that says Corso and Eisenhower. Now, our Eisenhower material is under is being worked on this week, but if they those who are near a computer would like to push the hit the from the homepage, hit the Corso and Eisenhower button, fifth one over from the right, that and then hit Corso again. It'll show you some stuff that we pulled up with Corso for his information, and he confirmed that there was a crash on the plane to San Augustine in a 1997 interview from Roswell. I believe Linda Moulton Howe was interviewing him, and he said, "Well, out here on the plane, there's also another crash, you know." So he was the first person that I was able to of note who confirmed this crash. Sorry. No, not the site, but the fact there was a crash.
I was fascinated by Corso's book. But getting back to your research and your dig, it's fascinating that you've may possibly, have found the site where Barnett and the archaeologist had spotted this thing.
There were UFO researchers had beat me there. I didn't was the first one, but in the early days, in the early 90s and late 80s, there was a lot of cutthroat going on among UFO researchers. Those who have been around a while can remember the kind of one group putting another group down, the kind of thing. And so finally, they had a big conference at Fund for UFO Research, but had a conference and told them all to cool it, and they did pretty well. But that was about 1990 or so, 91. But in any case, they all kind of fought over this, who was there, who wasn't there, but nobody really looked at it. They go out and visit there, and then so-and-so couldn't have been here, and so-and-so was here, and he wasn't there, he couldn't be there. So we had two people kind of vying for the guru or top dog in the UFO field and some of the leading writers. And so they all got kind of turned off about a year before that farmer told me about it. So none of them really spent any time there. So I started finding things immediately. I think they were looking at where the crash ended up, but not looking back in the desert, 100 yards back from where we found this stuff. So, yeah, it's very interesting, yeah. We were directed to the site by the farmer, who had known about it, who's all of UFO researchers, but they had not spent any time looking at the ground. Of course, you've got somebody from the east who may be a plumber or something, Joe the plumber type person. He's not going to know a lot about ground in the west. Or a guy like Friedman, this very nice man from Canada, he's not going to know very much about it either, but we had to just really, hunker down and start learning about it ourselves and what was happening in the plains and where the water went and how it flowed down the hills. So we spent quite a bit of time at it.
And you found so many interesting objects. It's just amazing to me. The way they covered your segment on UFO Hunters, to tell you the honest truth, I was kind of disappointed that they didn't really, cover it very much. I mean, this is some significant work that you've been doing.
Well, I keep being asked, what did I think about it? They spent 3 days with me, and then I think I maybe had a total of 3 or 4 minutes on the thing. I think, first of all, I think they reserve the right to use it later. So if they're going to do something later, then they can use the excerpts or new things that they didn't show. So they decided that they wanted to go on the theory that there is a second crash, and my material fit in quite well with that because we're sure there was one. So they just try to establish a simple point, and then they very seldom get anything that they can send to the laboratory. And they took that thing that we call the artifact down, that we took it down to SEAL Labs in Los Angeles, and we were there for a day. Of course, they didn't mention that I had gone through the same process in Portland, Oregon, 11 years before. They didn't say it had already been analyzed. And I was a little disappointed they didn't go into the cold wire and some of the other stuff that we found, but maybe in the future they will.
I noticed they didn't mention that at all, just the analysis of the plastic.
Well, the plastic is exactly what it is, it's not a very... I was really disappointed that I came back with the lab plastic, you know? Who's going to get excited about a piece of plastic? So then I started looking inside, and I found the starch. And then I found some copper wire, I found that gold wire, and so forth. So something was in that plastic. It had to be a medical container of some kind, probably in a body system.
It's a heat-resistant plastic, so if it had been melted, it would have to be an extreme temperature.
Polyethylene melts at around 250 to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. It would do that in your oven on medium. High-density polyethylene would melt down. It wouldn't go liquid, but it would... Any shape you had would be ruined if you laid out your oven rack.
Well, so, what I meant though was, you know, weather conditions. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, face it, part of New Mexico can get pretty hot, but
right,
not
yeah.
that hot.
Everyone that saw it said that it had to be in a high heat or an explosion to have belly like that. And we found on the bottom where it had apparently blown into the sand, and it was still soft, and we found places where there was sand had been embedded in the little rivulets at the bottom of the thing. So it would probably the explosion of a collision, or when the thing hit the ground, it could have been sucked out with by air pressure, like it would open the door of an airplane or something, and it had definitely been in a heat or an explosion. And there certainly wasn't anything like that in that part of the desert out there.
In the area that you're digging, obviously, is a very sparsely populated part of the state as well.
Yes, yeah, so I don't think there was... We could see a couple of ranches from windmills from where we were, a few buildings up along Highway 12, a little hamlet of a place called Horse Springs. This is very far away, but you're not seeing too many people there. You wouldn't pass five cars in 20 miles. On a dual lane road, and usually almost all of those are ranchers going to it from town or something. So, it's pretty sparsely populated, but there had been quite a number of Hispanic people there during World War II and shortly thereafter, when they were hired for the work of the nearby ranches, and so forth. But the defense industry. Pretty well fizzled after the war, and a lot of the people never came back. I saw an article written in the New Mexico magazine. Some gal got her first ride in a car in 1940. She was 8 years old. So, it's pretty sparsely populated, but there were a lot of Hispanic people there. Very nice people to deal with.
And the reason I bring that up is it's not quite a place that somebody would say, oh, let's just go. You know, like a bunch of teenagers or something going out and go, oh, let's just go have a bonfire, and then somebody throws some plastic into the fire. There's no charring, from what I can see on this piece, you know, from what photographs I've seen of it.
Well, we have a little bit of melting. I'm going back to that piece chapter 4. We have a little bit of, you see the brown, dark brown on the bottom edge of the artifact. Now you're looking at the top side of it, and the other side was brown, like a baked, well done turkey. And so what you're seeing there in chapter 4, under that ain't no pardon, no cow, what the people are looking at there is the top part had been scoured out by the sand over the years. And the darker brown color was embedded underneath the sand. And in, I believe it's 6, we can see, I think it's way back in, towards the end of the book, I think chapter 11 or so is a different views of it. And you can see the bottom part is brown and the top part is kind of milky colored like that. So that milky part had been scoured out by the sand over the years. And that's why it had become that way. But the other part, they buried. So it was half buried when I found it.
What I'm saying though is it doesn't look like it had been thrown into a fire. There's no blackening or carbonizing on it.
No, it had a very, I would say, a flash. A flash explosion of some kind. And we found that there had been fires there, but this wasn't near it. But we found the charcoal, we found that cross. A bit, two arms of that cross we had found in the next chapter were of the book were had been in a fire. Somebody had taken them and wired them together with baling wire. So, yeah. No, if it was in a fire, it would just be an explosion, you know, instantly, instantaneous. And so we do have it kind of worked up what it might have looked like before it went into the fire in the book. Taking what we could find from Colonel Corso and other places, we thought that the item might have been the central part of a Hartland combination. That's as close as we could come to anything we could guess at. But I found it. I'm hooked. I come back here. I keep back every other summer. I'm the mayor of a small town, and I forget to be the mayor. I'm going back to play. So I was in the Southern Oregon when I I driven down there when I found it, and I drove back. It's a 2,900 mile trip, round trip, about 6 to 7 times.
That's quite a ride.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but it's quite a project.
Now all of the material that you've found is it pretty much in like a spread pattern, so to speak, from the water coming through the arroyo?
Well, there was a concentration of it within. We figured that the craft had come in and cut a swath out of the sagebrush, and then there was another bare spot that looked like it had been filled in. So we think that what the Army was doing in there the next few days was filling in a trench, maybe as long as 75 to 100 yards. And because we've had the soil analyzed and found out that the soil in the center of the area we were working, 35, 40 feet wide and 200 feet long or so, was slightly different than the soil on the right and the soil on the left, but still the soil from nearby. So we hypothesized that they had taken soil from where the arroyo kind of plugged up, where it accumulated, brought it down with some kind of a mechanical device in 47 and spread it into the trench. And in so doing, they uncovered a lot of other stuff. And so I guess they looked real good when they got finished. It was kind of like icing a cake. But over the years, then, the stuff started coming up. And we think that may be why that cross was there, because people were visiting there. Probably some people on official business were visiting there to see if anything was, if they could find anything coming out of the ground. But it literally comes out of the ground. It's freezing and thawing, and the rain and wind will expose anything laying on the ground, including this wonderful projectile points and bones and what have you. So we found a couple bones there, too, but turned out to be coyote. and I think one was a poached deer. I found this one bone had a head cut off on the end, and oh boy, we had a field autopsy here. And your mind can go really crazy out there by yourself, and you come up with the darndest things. And I had it looked at by a specialist in Ashland, Oregon, that looks into various things around the world that anything dealing with animals. And she said, well, it's just a deer femur that's been whacked off. It was a hacksaw. So, but this was far more exciting, though, than that bone thing was. Well, when I found the bone, I was quite thrilled. But, you know, that the poor people out there didn't have a lot of money, and they're going to probably eat deer and whatever they can find. And
true.
That's just the way it always has been.
And I think it's significant, too, to mention that with the sagebrush being missing, most people don't realize that once sagebrush is either burned or taken out of the soil and goes away and there's a big area where there isn't any, that takes a very, very long time to come back.
Right. Yeah. Well, our spot, we flew over it, and we have aerial pictures in the book of the spot, and I laid aerial flagging tape on the ground and flew over it the next day and photographed it. And there's just a few twists of sagebrush coming back, but if this was taken out of there 50 years ago, well, of course the roots went too, and the roots were probably destroyed. So it's not like that, you know, they just kind of whack it off and it goes up again. But we did have it. I did go over the Geiger counter and make sure it wasn't radioactive, and all the things we could think of as to why there wouldn't be any sagebrush growing there when there was sagebrush to the right and left. Now, it wasn't thick on one side, but it wasn't definitely there. So, apparently, whatever happened to the soil here, it has been disturbed, because when we did our analysis, we found that the soil down the center was different than the soil on both sides. We had a very detailed soil analysis done in Sydney appendix of the UFO crash at St. Augustine book. And we were later on, and there was some dealing with General Ramey and that telegram he was holding. You know, people were trying to read this telegram that General Ramey was holding and some of the Roswell pictures.
Yes.
Well, they were able to read one interpretation was St. Augustine, St. Augustine Site 2 was one of them. So I took the liberty to put it in front of a book of the 1947 U.S. Air Force Site 2 Roswell week crash. And we know it, pretty sure it came down the night of the 1st or 2nd, because Barnett wasn't up there. His wife has him there on the 2nd in his diary. And so he could have been up there on the 2nd and discovered this thing. And so, it very well may have been associated with Roswell. That was what they tried to portray in the History Channel, and I certainly am not going to discourage it, because I think it was probably a different group of people there than what were at Roswell. We may have been dealing with one of the Air Force bases at of Albuquerque, or maybe a special unit out of White Sands, we're not sure. But they didn't handle things the same way they did over at Roswell. They were very quiet about it, professional about it. And of course, this was a smaller place, too. It could be easy to cover up over here. There weren't many people. And those who were there were visitors, you know. Only one guy lived near there. That'd be Barnett, and he was 60 miles away. But he's the only one they had to worry about. Where at Roswell, you had a whole crew of people.
And a lot of people associate what Mac Bravel found as being the crash site. And as you and I had discussed over the phone last night,
yes.
And I agree with this theory, is that what Bravel found was just a place where one of the objects came down and kind of hit the ground and bounced off.
Skipped, I think the skipped in was the term that I remember seeing, that they came in hard enough to lose quite a bit of material on the on the outside of whatever it was, but it still had enough momentum to stay in the air for quite a while. And I think they found the other site. I think they went over, I think it was almost another 20 miles towards the east end of the El Capitan mountain range over near Carrizozo. And it's my understanding that that's where they found the craft came to rest, and then they found the bodies. Where it was about 30 miles north of Carrizozo, New Mexico.
And oddly enough, Carrizozo is pretty close to the Trinity atomic bomb test site.
Yes, it is. Actually, they're 17 miles out of town, I think. There's a gate to back in there. They keep locked, and they open it on occasion for various things. But Colonel Corso had a anti-aircraft missile base near there, too. As a matter of fact, he said that they had his missile base lined up perfectly with the San Augustine planes and the Roswell crash, when he talked about the crash on the planes. So we got out a map, and sure enough, they had the northern end of the White Sands missile range was a facility where they were firing anti-aircraft guided missiles at targets and so forth. And he was in charge of that. Then he took his whole unit to Germany. I think this was the late 50s, early 60s. And
and Carrizozo, to kind of give people an idea of the location, Carrizozo is, I believe, southeast of Socorro, kind of between Roswell and
13 miles
and
south
Socorro.
And about 40 miles east. You're exactly right. And it's almost halfway between Roswell and Socorro.
And a lot of people, you know, and then if you realize, too, that the ranch where Mac Braswell was working, he didn't own the ranch. He was a ranch hand,
right,
or foreman, right, or whatever. And where his ranch, where the ranch was, is kind of northwest of Roswell.
Right. Well, that lines up, though, with the 30 miles north of Carrizozo. I understand one of the directions was in the towards a place called Boy Scout Mountain, and that the UFO was found in that area up there. Now, it's on private land, and I do have the GPS coordinates, but I've never been in there myself. But the people who worked the Roswell case, Kevin Randall and Don Smith and Tom Carey, and I think you've had some of them on your show, that was the site that they think that the real UFO landed. There was one north of Roswell that, guys, they had people building monuments there and doing seances and prayers and everything there, and apparently that wasn't the right site. Well, I don't know whether their ceremonies did any good or not, but apparently that was the one called the Ragsdale site, and I guess he got kind of discredited. So I think this one, though, that is not very easy to get to, and you got to go through some block gates. And the ranchers are very, very careful about telling people where things are, and it took me a few years to get the confidence of the rancher that where I was still working, because I had to go through a gate and then had a combination, and I had to get the combination every year. They had about three gates, and they would rotate the combination locks around. So they, well, which combination do you have this time? And particularly during the hunting season and other times in the fall, a lot of people come from the cities, and they're not as careful as they could be with shooting. And a lot of them will generally pick up their cattle and take them somewhere. They just keep them away from the highways at that time of year, totally. And so.
Well, personally, I don't blame the ranchers. Could you see having, you know, hundreds of people descending on a rancher's property just to, you know, I hate to say this, but there is the tinfoil hat brigade out there.
They're worried about people with guns, and in close proximity to cattle, even if you don't shoot a cow, you can sure stampede them, you know. And the calves, and so you don't want them, the cattle running around out there. They get so much pound for them, they don't want to lose weight. But I think that they've had enough people come and go out there where they discourage it. So I had to more or less tell the rancher that I'd keep the site quiet. And while I worked there, and generally before I went back home, I would just stop by and show what I found and things like that. So, I got to know them pretty well, and go and have a drink or a taco or something, and they're just like anybody else. They have their own interests at heart, and their cattle and the weather are the foremost things in their mind, of course.
You know, and one thing else I wanted to ask you too. You were talking about, you know, researchers and whatnot, and when you get down to the bunkers end of it, or even just people who you know, just the average Joe that hasn't done any research on the subject, why do you think so many of them try to make it or change the stories around to fit stuff that doesn't even agree with what's been reported? Why do so many people try to put something different into the story?
Well, I'll tell you what, I have some interesting theories on that. I'm so glad you asked. What interests me is they take five people see something in the desert, let's say a phoenix. So they get some guy in Kentucky, and he said, well, it's just a hit in the gods experience out there. There's nothing out there in the skies, and they're seeing them things. And well, you know, what I want to see is one of these people who was at a sighting with five witnesses, and he didn't see anything. But no, they put him in, get somebody out of Kentucky who, so they go to great lengths to portray the other side of the question, but they really have to go search hard to find some people. And then the people on the History Channel told me they don't do it, but a lot of your big time investigators and shows pay people to say negative things. They're not doing it for free. Their way is paid to the nearest studio, and you know, they're all dressed up and coats and ties and the whole thing, and some of those guys get up to $2,500 for saying UFOs don't exist. Well, that was a surprise to me. I thought they were, you know, doing all this out of the goodness of their heart, and apparently they need to have that other balanced view, they call it. Yeah, but I don't think it's very balanced. So there's enough of that leaves doubt that does anything happen at all, and people will kind of go about their own way. Then the press have only picked up the local sightings, and it's not picked up in towns anywhere around there. So you don't get the idea you have a regional thing. Now that's this thing down in Texas is different because it did get picked up by national press. But more and more national press places in different parts of the country are picking up stories now. But it used to be you'd have a spectacular a sighting. Well, those people down at Phoenix or those people down at Podunk, or you know, they obviously don't know what they're looking at, so forth and so on, and so they wouldn't put a lot of credence in the fact that somebody else saw something. Of course, it's different when you see something, you know. So, but they keep it kind of isolated by only letting the local reporters talk about what they see in the sky, but it isn't picked up generally by other bigger papers or regional pair of papers. They're starting to do it more now, though.
Yeah, I kind of had to chuckle on one of the Larry King Lives when they had Bill Nye, the science guy, on there as their skeptic expert. I thought, oh, God, this guy who used to do a TV show for kids.
Okay. Yeah, so did Deputy Dan and a bunch of others, but... you just need to have somebody who's articulate and give the other side of the point. And this is what they call balanced news, but I think they've gone overboard by picking somebody so far away, generally who knows so little. And Stanton Friedman went on several debates with some of the well-known debunkers, and they wouldn't even read the material that was assigned them. They just had their own theories. So he zapped several people in debates that didn't even have hadn't even read the material. So I think that it's a matter of pride that they don't know, and they're not willing to look. I had a falling out with an astronomy teacher here in Southern Oregon where I live, and he said, "This has nothing to do with this thing," and I could prove it. I said, "Fine, we'll see your proof." And the friendship ended there, so he didn't wasn't close, but we had played poker together, and and he was just incensed that, you know, he had the information and no one else could have it. But you know, we've got to take anything that comes along in our life and look at it from different sides. And I would encourage anyone who's any interest at all in UFOs to go to the shelf of the library. Not necessarily the internet, but go to the library shelf. You find some really good material there. And read what you can. Make up your own mind. It's very important. Because I've never seen what I consider to be a UFO. But I certainly have been around the field long enough to met people who have.
I've had a few sightings myself, and I tell you, they were amazing. I find it kind of interesting that a lot of researchers, Stan Friedman for one, from what I understand, Hynek never even had a sighting. They've all let the preponderance of the evidence convince them.
Well, you, when you're in academia, you've got to kind of play the game by the rules, and the rules are that you don't embrace kooky causes, or you won't be in academia very long. So they have more at stake here than just whether they saw something or didn't see something. Their livelihoods are at stake, their reputations are at stake, and so on. So you can't blame them for being conservative. On the other hand, they say an Austrian that paints a target in a vulnerable place is in for a surprise. And you don't want to be that either, take your head in the sand. So we're seeing change. When I started speaking UFOs in the 50s, I go to service clubs and Optimist and Kiwanis and other clubs. And I don't think there were 5% of the people believed in life on other planets. And those days, they were talking about whether so-and-so was a communist or not. It was quite Tombaugh go to communist meetings, cell meetings in the 1930s, because this was the McCarthy era. So they were kind of taking that to heart. Now I speak, and 60%, 70% of the people believe that life is possible on other planets, and many believe in UFOs. And then we'll talk about general audiences, not UFO audiences here. So they say, well, when is disclosure going to happen? Well, disclosure has been happened in your own mind over the period of time, and where you are pretty well convinced that there's something going on here. I wouldn't be in this thing 50 years if I hadn't thought there was something to it. And I was astounded to find this material lay on the ground. Absolutely astounded.
Well, and as you mentioned disclosure, as we talked last night again on the phone, you had mentioned your surprises at Edgar Mitchell coming forward with information he had received from the Pentagon.
Yes, I had been following his talk still. So I have just about the same amount of time anybody else does. I get on the internet, do what I need to, and the chores around the house, and, you know, the whole thing. I'm a retired teacher and 76 years old, so I've been around the block a few times. But we just can't know everything that's going on. Well, when he went to the moon, he was on the Apollo 14, I believe it was 1971, somewhere in there, maybe 72. He had done some extraterrestrial, some ESP experiments, And at the time, I was sort of interested, but it was in the middle of that period where I wasn't doing any research. I thought, well, let's see. It's nice to see an astronaut out there trying some of this stuff, you know. And I had started the UFOs and then kind of gotten out of it for a while and then got back into it around 89 or so. But he came out with a statement on a British rock station and said a lot more than I had understood he had ever said. And that the UFOs have been around for 60 years, the government's covered them up. And then he said, we've been in contact for 50 years. Well, think back who was president 50 years ago. Eisenhower. It would be his last term, last year of his term. So if he said this a year or two ago, so we're going to be talking about that next week, aren't we? So we have information that Eisenhower may have met with the occupants of a UFO at Holloman Air Force Base in 1955. An airman who had been to one of my talks came forward and asked me if I was interested in this material in that era. I said, sure. So he wrote about a 7-page letter. And we have his voice and everything for that program next week. So stuff is starting to come out of various sources, and people are not much less much more prone now to come out than they would have been 25, 30 years ago. I can't explain it all, but it's good.
Do you think that a lot of these people, such as like this Earl Forfert that was on the UFO Hunters program that they had you on, he was 80-something years old, I forget, like 82, 83, something like that. Do you think these people that were involved in this back then are coming forward because they know, well, you know, I'm like 80-some-odd years old, what are they going to do to me?
Well, that's what I understand. Finally, Corso kept waiting for something to come out, and I think he was 86 or 7 when he passed away in 97. And, you know, you've got your pension, if you had one, and... you've done your service. You kept kept quiet, and now it seems like the doors are opening a crack here and there, and people are reporting these things now. And so, you know, if you had an experience and you had to keep it quiet, well, why not come out with it? People aren't looking down upon people now who come out with something like they would have 25 or 30 years ago. If this archaeologist, for instance, that said we were over there where that UFO crashed and got chased away by the army, well, he wouldn't have gotten funding for his dig the next year, not out of Harvard. So there was lots of reasons for people to be real quiet in the 40s and 50s. But now we've been out in space for almost 40, well, since the 1960s and before that. It just loosens up a little bit more as more and more people get acclimated to us being out there and astronauts and... I understand there's about 20 or so astronauts who have seen UFOs in space. And we see once or twice, we see them on Larry King Live. And these include cosmonauts, astronauts, and even one or two of the Chinese astronauts have had UFO experiences in space. And have talked about
Gordon Cooper, when... I believe it was Edwards Air Force Base that he was stationed at the time.
Right. Yeah.
Was working with a film crew that was filming, landings, landing aircraft.
Sure. Yeah.
And an object came down and landed on the end of the runway, and the crew that he was working with got it all on film.
Right. Then he turned the film in and never heard a thing. You know, so. Somewhere there's a lot of archives back there, somebody said, you know, this thing that you found out there at the plain of St. Augustine, the government may have a whole shelf of those. I keep getting asked from people if anybody from the government has ever come around and contacted me. Well, not yet, but I'm ready for them whenever they come. The other day I was sitting at my computer near the window at a two guys in black suits have pulled up in a white car, and I thought, oh boy. And of course, they were kind of lost, so they went towards my entryway. And I said, I told my wife to where's my lawyer's card? I need it. She told me if I ever got a question to pound the card, I wouldn't have to answer questions. You know, say I'm being represented, and that would, you know, keep asking questions. I opened the door to two guys there with the biggest old Bible you ever saw, and I'd tell me, trying to convert me, and says, I don't know what you're doing, but come on in, I'm pouring. So, you get a few funny things happen to you.
Oh, for a moment there, you thought the men in black were visiting?
Yeah, all right. I was, you're a little paranoid. No, I haven't had anyone come to me yet, but it could be that, as a matter of fact, Ed Mitchell said on that Kerrang radio show that people were being bumped off and disappeared for coming forward a few years back. He mentions that specifically. You know, he says that they aren't doing that so much now. And I'm very glad they're not doing it now. But
I remember a few years back reading a website about just that. You know, all these scientists that were interested in the subject and just researchers in general that were coming up missing or found dead.
Right. Well, you know, there was some really the most recent one, a well-known person, was Congressman Schiff of New Mexico. He was going to get to the bottom of some things, and first thing you know, he had was it a heart attack or something, and he's gone. And you always wonder if that was just a coincidence or whether there was, you know, something really going on. Well, the question is the government know? Well, they think there's an international group that probably some cartel somewhere who's very threatened, would be very threatened with the full disclosure of UFOs because of the fact that there'd be problems with people trying different kinds of power. Of course, certainly what would we have to lose with the economy where it is now? You know, now would be a pretty good time to talk about it. And maybe some people would have some hope that we could maybe find out our government has been working for 35 or 40 years and has some alternative power sources. So that'd be a pretty hopeful thing to come out right now with the way things are.
And speaking of that, how close do you think we might be to some kind of American government disclosure? I know the British has come forward with their UFO files, the French, Brazil, and all that. How close do you feel we might be to it?
Well, I defer to the Internet, and I was looking at Steve Bissett's material the other day. He's a gentleman with the Exopolitics organization back near Washington, D.C., and he seemed to think that the Obama administration, everybody there that he picked for the cabinet was aware of UFOs and wouldn't be object to them being talked about. Then, of course, a week or so ago, this Leon Panetta gets appointed the CIA director. Well, he was with Clinton, and he had made comments on UFOs. Your listeners might want to Google Leon Panetta, UFOs. I can't tell you exactly when and what he said, but I think he said that it's time that we knew had the truth about them, and this is when he was not in public office. But now he's the director of the CIA. I don't know whether we're going to hear from him or not. you wouldn't have the director of the CIA coming out and talking about UFOs at this point, I don't think. But anyhow, there's some in the UFO community, including Stephen Bissett, that think that this is the right time and that part of the selection of the cabinet and officers deals with is made of people who could who have been versed in UFOs, and the top one on the list apparently is Hillary Clinton, our new Secretary of State, starting about 2 weeks. So she has apparently been in contact with the Rockefeller group, and they had conferences and so forth there. And so at least we'd have people there who know about it, and we know they know. So it's going to be very interesting to see if anything comes out.
Makes me wonder if they do the same thing to Obama as they did to Goldwater, telling you don't have the need to know.
Well, I don't know. That's good, because this letter that Kehoe wrote Truman mentions Senator Barry Goldwater and how he felt about things. And I don't know if they could pull it off now or not, but it's certainly going to be interesting. I don't know that it's imminent, but I'm not sure we're going to have a big disclosure, because I've seen it gradually happening. It's been accelerated the last 5 or 6 years, and as people get an education and you see the what's going on in outer space, and that we've been there with rockets, and they've got probes landing now on Mars, and so forth and so on, we get more and more closer to believing in ourselves. So I'm not sure we're going to have a big disclosure. I think it's going to be small steps rather than big ones. But the British have come out and started releasing their UFO files. French came out a couple of years ago. And somebody said, well, goodness gracious, I hope they read the Chinese. We announce what we know before they do. We look pretty silly, you know, we'll be the only major power that doesn't know anything. So things are looking interesting.
Oh, wow. And, you know, 2 hours have just flown by. We're all out of time.
Well, we are. Well, I've certainly enjoyed talking at you. I didn't get to learn too much about you, but I guess your listeners don't know about your background. But
then you'll be back next week, and we'll be talking about Eisenhower and E.T.
Right, and I'll try to get that. My website's still being worked on, but we'll be able to even give you the voices of the people who are witnesses next week who saw his plane there or saw something connected with him landing there.
And that will be for next week, and we are totally out of time. I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight and everyone for tuning in, and those who joined us in our Pal Talk Auditorium. And stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, her guest is author Ann Andrews. And please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be again, Art Campbell, and we'll be talking about former President Eisenhower and his stories that he had met with ETs at Holloman Air Force Base. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this Saturday's live global broadcast of Voice of the People on the Paranormal Radio Network. There are several listening venues.